Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with science reporter Lori Garrett. She works for Newsday, and we'll be talking about a new book that she's authored. The title is Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. Hyperion is the publisher of the book. In the introduction to this book, she explains that it follows from a previous work that came out a couple of years ago. That book was titled The Coming Plague, which looked at the reemergence of infectious diseases around the world. She explains that when that book came out, she says that she was deluged with demands for solutions. People wanted to know, well, what do we do about this problem? So at that point, she started to explore the issue of public health. And she traveled around the world. She was in the former Soviet Union. She was in India. She was in Africa and also in the United States. And her conclusion after all of this is that public health systems around the world are not prepared to face the health challenges of the next century. And that is what Betrayal of Trust is all about. And that'll be the topic of our conversation this morning. Just a little bit more by way of background on Lori Garrett. She studied biology. In fact, she graduated with honors in biology from University of California, Santa Cruz, and then went to graduate school at UC Berkeley. However, when she was there working on her PhD, she also started science reporting at KPFA radio there. The hobby soon became more interesting than graduate school for her. She took a leave of absence to explore journalism, and she never went back. In 1980, she went to work for National Public Radio, and then in 1988, she left NPR to join the science writing staff of Newsday. She's also written for other publications, including Foreign Affairs, Esquire, Vanity Fair, the LA Times, and the Washington Post. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk with Lori Garrett, you can certainly call in and ask your own questions. All we ask of callers is that people are brief so that we can keep our show moving along and accommodate anybody who would like to call in. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel. That's 800-222-9455. You match the numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL. So 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Garrett, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. You suggest that if we went out on the street and we just started asking people, what is public health? What do we mean by that phrase? That probably most people wouldn't be able to give us much of an answer. And also you suggest that even if we went and talked to people who were in the field of public health, there at least we might get some disagreement. We'd get different definitions of what it is.
Oh, it's really striking. Surveys that have been done recently show that even if you do a multiple-choice quiz where, you know, the kind we all like to get in high school where the answer was actually buried in one in the list, you know, that about 87% of the public surveyed will incorrectly designate the definition of public health, even when the correct definition is on the list. And perhaps even more alarming, the deans of the 28 graduate schools of public health in the United States commissioned a survey to look at how the public sees the term public health, what they think it means and what they think it does and how they think it affects their lives. And the responses were so negative that the deans of the schools of public health were actually and are actually contemplating changing the name of the discipline simply because the public has, in the United States, not elsewhere in the world, this is a uniquely American problem, the public has a highly negative view of the term public health, which they have incorrectly defined.
Well, what is public health?
Public health is what protects you and me and everybody, rich and poor alike, regardless of where they live, regardless of what they do for a living. It's what makes sure that the water that comes out of your tap is safe for you and your children, what makes sure the air is as safe to breathe as possible and tries to stop polluters who make the air unsafe. It's what tries to keep track of epidemics and stop them before your children get infected and perhaps die. It is population health. It is the protection of whole communities. Medicine is the protection of the individual and the health of the individual. Public health is about the community as a whole. And the reason I titled my book Betrayal of Trust is because public health really is a trust. It's a trust entered into between government and the people. And on the people's side, their side of the trust is, we agreed to abide by the recommendations and regulations that are set down by the public health experts, the scientists and physicians in charge, even if they're individually a little uncomfortable, even if I don't feel individually like getting immunized, for example, or letting you come on my land to inspect my drinking water well, I understand that it's for the good of the community as a whole, so I'll make that sacrifice. And on the government side of that trust is, we will wisely use your tax dollars, and we guarantee you we will do everything within our powers to make your water safe, your air safe, and so on, to make sure your children go to school with immunized children so that disease doesn't spread in school while you're off at work, and on and on and on. And the problem is that the trust is collapsing everywhere around the world. The trust has broken down. In the United States, the side of the trust that is the weakest is the public side. Overseas, in most of the world, the side of the trust that has most been betrayed is the side of government.
Just to, you know, not to put too fine a point on this, but I think that you do encourage people to think, to rethink this, the question of how is it that over the last couple of hundred years, people live longer and people are healthier, and we probably tend to attribute that to modern medicine and specifically antibiotics and vaccines. And while those things have been important, much of the improvement in health and the increase in longevity actually came before those things were developed.
It's startling when you really go through the numbers. And I went through old colonial health records. I went through numbers going back to the 1600s. And when you really go through it, you could see that the vast majority of improvement in life expectancy, in infant mortality, and all the things that really matter, whether you get to live a long life and your children are guaranteed to survive childhood, most of that improvement was made before 1940. And in fact, the vast majority of it was made before 1900. And since World War II, medicine has contributed less than 4% to the total increase in life expectancy for Americans.
One of the points, the strong points that you make is that public health systems are subject to a lot of pressure. And when things within countries and within societies, when things are not going well, or if you look at places where they've decided they're going to cut their public spending, it seems that in both cases, it's public health systems that are the first things to go.
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Because public health is a negative. When everything's going perfectly for public health, nothing happens. Nobody has an epidemic, or if an epidemic starts, it gets snuffed out right away. There's no big health catastrophes. Nobody's complaining that the water isn't safe, and so on. And so public health, when it's at its peak and everything's going perfectly, it's easy to ignore it because nothing's going wrong. In contrast, I mean, nobody says cut the fire department because everybody has seen a fire in their life. And they all know, oh my gosh, I hope the firefighters can get here in 10 seconds if my house catches on fire. And the same with the police if you're worried about theft or mugging or getting shot. But public health is vaguer in most Americans' lives because we are wealthy enough that our homes and our basic environments are comparatively safe compared to, say, two generations ago or to much of what exists overseas. So Americans can get very, callous about public health. Overseas, the problem is much, much worse. It's really that you have heads of state who frankly just don't care about the health of their people. They just frankly don't give a damn. Mm. And they shuttle money off to develop nuclear weapons or to buy a Mercedes-Benzes for their children and so on and so forth, but they're not spending on the clinics and the corruption is so intense that really it's about, you know, go ahead and die. We don't care what happens to you. So public health suffers from both its own success in the wealthy world so that it allows the public to become complacent and allow politicians to just hack away at the budget whenever they feel like it. And overseas, it suffers because if a leader is corrupt, a leader doesn't give a darn about the health of the masses.
I should introduce again at this point, quickly, our guest. We're talking with Lori Garrett. She is a science writer for Newsday and is the author of a recently published book. The title is Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. It's published by Hyperion. If you're interested in these subjects, you might also go back and look at her previous book, The Coming Plague. That was published in 1994, which looked at the reemergence of infectious disease around the world. And certainly the two things are very connected. Questions also are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. You present a number of case studies. You look at the outbreak of plague in India, Ebola in Africa, and also you were in the former Soviet Union, where they have a variety of problems, including they have seen an outbreak of and spread of resistant strains of tuberculosis. Each of those cases is, in a sense, a little bit different, but all of them illustrate the points that you've been making here. India was a case where the government decided it was going to devolve responsibility for public health onto the states and, of course, didn't give them any money, and they didn't have the money, and that it seems that there was a real a case in point of no one really claiming responsibility and no one really deciding that they would allocate the resources to do the job that needed to be done.
And in fact, worse yet, they actually dismantled many essential public health programs that had been working, just completely eliminated them, one of which had been a plague monitoring program that had gone out routinely and collected rats and tested them and so on, because India had suffered massive deaths due to plague at the turn of the century. It had devastated parts of India. So they had once had a real surveillance, and then they just dropped it. They just said, who needs it? Got rid of it. And so they were caught completely by surprise when plague emerged first in Maharashtra state in bubonic form, meaning it was spread via the fleas and the rats, and then in pneumonic form, spread directly from person to person in the city of Surat up in the state of Gujarat.
And this is the same disease, we should point out, that caused so much death in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, the Black Death of the 14th century was plague, the same bacterial disease. And what really comes through in the India case that is so striking is, first, we didn't understand where all the money of India was going, because India's in a time of great prosperity for that nation. Their economy is really growing. So why couldn't they have a public health system? Why were they completely dismantling all concern and attention to their people? And the answer turns out to be because they were busy making thermonuclear weapons, which we didn't know at the time, and which were only announced after a couple of years after the plague. But the other piece that's illustrated by the plague outbreak in India that I think is really important for Americans to understand is that plague is a completely treatable, preventable, simple disease in modern medicine and modern public health. We know that the cheapest antibiotics on the market, tetracycline, doxycycline, will completely prevent you from getting infected. You could take them prophylactically, once you get infected, you know, they will reverse the course of infection unless you've allowed it to go all the way to the worst level. And so there was no reason for there to be this global panic. There was no reason for the entire world community to have gone into a complete state of hysteria over this epidemic. The World Health Organization should have stepped in and said, people, calm down. This is not a big deal. But they said nothing. For like 2 weeks, they said nothing and allowed this thing to spin out of control. And then Pakistan rather cynically used the plague in India as a weapon against their old nemesis for political reasons and got away with it and called upon all the Islamic states to join in a massive boycott of India because of the great threat of plague spreading around the world, so that all Indian goods were boycotted and travel was boycotted and the stock market collapsed on Bombay and the economy of India lost at least $2 billion, conservative estimate, overnight. And this was all inexcusable. It showed a complete lack of both national leadership in India and international leadership at WHO and so on. I mean, for England, modern UK, which should know better, damn it, to have said, okay, we're going to hold these Indian airplane travelers off in solitary confinement because we don't want to spread plague in England, for Russia, China, country after country to boycott all Indians, hold their planes out on runways in miserable heat and not let them out of their airplanes. I mean, this is ridiculous. It wasn't the 14th century. And so all I could say, it was a clear example of a complete lack of public health leadership at all tiers, from the local all the way up to the international.
Something else that you write about is the way that we have changed the way that we think about why people get sick. And that this also has a lot to do with the move away from infectious diseases being the big problem to chronic diseases. If we go back We don't have to go back all that far, and we ask, well, what was it that killed people? It was mostly infectious disease. Now, once we did those things that we've talked about, once we got better at handling human waste and made it possible for people to have clean water, and then took it a couple of steps further, and we also had antibiotics and vaccines, we got to the point where infectious disease wasn't that much of a problem, and because people had to die of something, we started to see people dying of things like cancer and heart disease. And those things do have lifestyle components. So we got into this frame of mind, and partly, I guess, it was the result of public education programs. We got into this frame of mind that says, you're responsible for your health, which, and that take that argument one step further, it means, well, if you get sick, it's your fault.
Yeah, we blame the victim.
Exactly.
And that's where we are now. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the blame the victim approach to health is very convenient for insurance providers and for managed care industry and for those who seek to see medicine as a marketplace, because then you, the health individual, the target, are a consumer. And if it's buyer beware, if you fail to consume and use the product correctly, well, we can't be held responsible if the product failed. So suddenly health becomes just another consumer item. And you bad little thing, you smoked, it's all your fault you have cancer. You bad little thing, you overate, it's your fault that you have heart disease and diabetes. And you ate too much butter, and for every stick of butter, you should slap yourself on your back, and that's why you have a heart problem, and so on and so forth. So we really have individualized health increasingly and radically, with the health providers having this sort of chastiser, you know, big mama role, you know, you behave yourselves, kids. And we've made it so that if you're ill, you feel guilty. But, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've interviewed people in the United States, and you don't hear this overseas. You don't. This is so culturally unique to America. I cannot tell you how many times I've interviewed people, and they've been deathly ill, and they've said, yeah, you know, it's all my fault. I did X, Y, and Z. Well, yes, you should take responsibility for your health. I'm all for that. But the truth of the matter is, most of the things that really affect the how and what kind of shape your body is and how it will function and survive in the environment as a whole as you go through life are decided in childhood. It has to do with what you were exposed to in childhood, how athletic you were, what you ate, what infectious diseases you had. Even in utero, we now have strong indications that diseases like autism and many forms of mental illness originate as infectious disease problems that the fetus is exposed to during pregnancy. So as we go through life, we should be thinking, where do you want to spend your money and how do you want to focus on the individual? Do you want to sit around endlessly telling women, you're going to have osteoporosis unless you take this giant calcium pill every day, even though we know full well that once a woman goes through menopause, she doesn't even have the appropriate estrogens to take care of uptake and put that calcium in her bones to make them strong so she won't have osteoporosis. And we know full well that what really decides whether you're going to have osteoporosis when you're 70 is what you ate when you were 7. What we really have to change our focus, that we're not scolding the adult, but helping the parent to raise a healthier child. And yet, here in our society, 1 out of 5 children have no access to primary health care. And it's just, we've warped our entire perspective. We spend almost 1/4 of all our health dollars on the last year of life. And in fact, almost 20% on the last 2 weeks of life. We're the biggest health spending society in the world, bar none, not even close to anybody else. And we have the worst public health markers of the industrialized world. It's just insane. And why is it happening? Why does Costa Rica have better life expectancy than we do with a society that has 10% of the per capita income we have? Because they spend on children. They spend on community health. They spend on public health. And they make sure that their children are as healthy as a child can possibly be, a collective commitment by the entire society, so that then they can go on and lead a healthier adult life, while we're spending a bloody fortune on keeping people on machinery for another week, another 2 weeks, another 3 weeks. We've just lost sight of where we should be.
We have a caller here. We'd welcome others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, by the way, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Callers in Bloomington, Indiana, and it's line 4. Hello?
Hi. Do you regard AIDS as a communicable infectious disease?
I certainly do.
Well, it has utterly devastated Africa. It is caused by misbehavior. Of course, it's hurt our country, too. But it seems as if when we know the cause of this infectious disease, precious little is done to correct the misbehavior that causes it.
Well, when you say misbehavior, let me question one thing here. First, I write a great deal about AIDS and how we should have dealt with it as a public health issue versus a medical issue, and why we ended up adopting a medicalized model of AIDS, and why that now puts us in such a sorry state in terms of being able to control this epidemic. So I strongly believe that we need to rethink our entire approach to HIV and take a much more aggressive public health approach. But when you say misbehavior, let me just point a couple factoids out, if I may. First of all, by 2004, AIDS, HIV, will have eclipsed the Black Death of the 14th century and the 1918 influenza pandemic, thereby ranking as the worst epidemic in the history of humanity. It will have killed more people than any other infectious epidemic agent ever did, and it will be completely out of control. I have spent much of my career for the last 20 years going in and out of the same African villages and chronicling the impact this epidemic is having on sub-Saharan Africa. And I can tell you that nothing that you imagine and nothing you've ever read about the 14th century in Europe with the plague comes close to what HIV has done to the social fabric, the economy, the lives, the very essence of the cultures of these hardest-hit regions of Africa. So there's no doubt in my mind that AIDS represents the greatest public health catastrophe of all time, and the greatest challenge to public health of all time. And it is one that finds us with a very limited set of weaponry in our public health toolbox. We were so cocky when HIV appeared, so convinced of our scientific skills and our medical skills that we absolutely believed that we'd have a cure and a vaccine popping out of a laboratory somewhere within 5 years.
So
we took this whole attitude towards the problem that focused on it as a technological solution, quick fix problem. Now we find ourselves 20 years into this epidemic and no closer to having a reasonable vaccine than we did 20 years ago, and certainly no closer to having a cure, and with a medicalized treatment model that requires that you spend $20,000 a year for intensive management on a combination of toxic drugs, a model that can't be implemented anywhere outside the wealthiest parts of the world, and it is very difficult for patients to adhere to. So we went for a model that was more like treating cancer than treating infectious disease. Now, when you talk about misbehavior, I have to assume that then you want to take a moral solution to the epidemic.
Not necessarily. I would like a reasonable epidemiological response. That is to say, in some states, doctors, by law, are not allowed to inform the spouse of an AIDS patient.
Yes.
In other words, the doctor knows that this patient has AIDS. He knows the patient is going to give AIDS to his wife, and he can't inform his wife.
Yes.
By law. That's criminal.
Yes, well, there are many states that are now slowly beginning to change those kinds of laws. And one of the reasons is because now we have treatments. So now it really is criminal. I mean, we know that the earlier you get into treatment, the earlier you begin management in the course of your infection, the better your prognosis. So in fact, it shifts the whole ethical burden for physicians. They really have to get in there and try to encourage the patient to bring in all their sex partners, their spouse, their whoever they've been sharing needles with as an IV drug user. But on the international level, the problem is AIDS is now spreading most rapidly in societies where the power imbalance between the genders is the most acute. And when I say that, people think I'm talking about Muslim countries, and that doesn't make sense. But actually, on a personal family level, the power imbalance in Muslim households is not that extreme. What is extreme is what you see in places like the lower castes of India, all over sub-Saharan Africa, where and in increasingly in much of Asia, where women cannot have any say-so about the timing of sexual activity, about who they have sex with, and about what the nature of the activity is. And they cannot say to their partner, you must use a condom.
Yeah.
I have interviewed hundreds and hundreds of women around the world who knew their husband was infected. They knew their husband was cheating on them. They knew their husband was infected. They couldn't do anything about it. If they tried to question it, they got beaten. And they had no cash income because they were housewives or farmers or what have you, so they couldn't take the children and walk away from the marriage. Therefore, helplessly and terrified,
yes,
every single night they went to bed with their husband. It was like having Russian roulette, like having a bullet pointed at them. These women desperately need help, but what can we do for them? We need to develop a microbicide so that it's something that a woman can use to protect herself that is not under her physical control, not under the man's control. But we also need to see that it's not a moral issue for these women. It's about correcting the fact that they need to be able to have the wherewithal to walk away from,
yes,
marriages that are lethal experiences. And that means finding ways that women can earn money, finding ways to change this gender imbalance in these communities where HIV is sweeping through so rapidly. It really is a large-scale kind of social issue that is far, far bigger than most of the things that we've tried to deal with here in this country.
I need to jump in here. We're a little bit past the midpoint, and I am starting to get some other callers. I just want to, though, now listening to what you just said there in response to the last caller, it goes back, and my mind goes back to our discussion at the beginning about what public health is. It sounds to me like the kinds of things that you're talking about there go way beyond what I would think would be the mission of public health. Aren't we getting into a different sort of area here? We're talking about social engineering. It's not public health.
Well, no. Let me explain it to you this way. One of the things when I was doing research for Betrayal of Trust and trying to find examples where things worked and where public health had really dramatically reversed a nasty course of events, one of the impressive efforts is UNICEF's effort to vaccinate the children of the world against the six totally vaccine-preventable diseases, you know, diphtheria, polio, measles, and so on. And one of the things that UNICEF discovered as they were going around the world and finding the places where they were having the most frustration, the most difficulty trying to get the children in and getting them vaccinated properly, was that the one factor that most determines the long-term health outcome of a child, whether it be about whether the child gets immunized or whether they eat properly or what have you, is the educational status of the mother. It almost no factor associated with child health tracks with the father. It tracks with the educational status of the mother. So if she's illiterate, the child's health is actually directly imperiled. And as you improve the knowledge base of the mothers, you get improvement in health of the children. So UNICEF has, in fact, found that the best public health intervention they can carry out is to now link child immunization programs, child diarrhea programs, all these life-saving efforts for the children with serious ongoing educational efforts of the mothers and at the ministerial levels in these countries to try and encourage ministers of education to broaden their scope beyond just educating boys, so that the future generation of mothers will better understand some basic concepts so that they can realize that, yes, well, this is what a balanced diet is. This is what my child should eat, rather than just stick to old superstitious ways, old woman's tales that often result in doing exactly the wrong things for your children and lead you to be suspicious of essential public health interventions and things that can save your child's life. So I understand your criticism that this is sounding like social engineering, but it's not. It's about, again, embracing the community as a health target and seeing what are the things in the community that imperil health. And sometimes in Betrayal of Trust, I found that what imperiled health was the government itself, as in the case of Zaire, with the corrupt dictatorship of Mobutu Sese Seko and the resultant, amongst other things, Ebola epidemic. But in many cases, it's more about cultural attitudes and social attitudes, and these things must be confronted or you will have continued spread. You know, it's not a coincidence that as we go into the 21st century, the most dangerous epidemic is one that exploits human sexual behavior, because that's the hardest thing for anybody to confront, to change, to do social education about, because we consider it so private.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Lori Garrett. She's a science writer at Newsday. Before going to work at Newsday, she was for a number of years a science reporter at National Public Radio. She has won a number of awards for her work, including the Peabody, the Polk, and the Pulitzer. She's the author of this new book that we've mentioned. It's titled Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. It's published by Hyperion. Also, you might be interested in looking at her 1994 book, The Coming Plague, which is about the emergence, re-emergence of infectious disease around the world. And certainly the two subjects are very much connected. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, a toll-free 800-222-WILL. We'll go again here to another caller. Next, Champaign County, line one.
Hi, excuse me if I missed this because I have been having to tune in and out. What about the critique of what's called neoliberalism elsewhere in the world and is not called much of anything except for standard operating practices here? We have the statistic, and I don't know if this is exactly right, but this sort of captures the idea that Mozambique pays more in debt service than in all of its education and social programs combined. And this has pretty much been exacted by the IMF and World Bank. And this is the criticism that, you know, people that are against anti-corporate globalization make, that we are, it's mainly the U.S., so I can say we, I guess, are acting through these international organizations to impose this kind of austerity, restricting government expenditures. The irony is that we have done otherwise in the past as far as, you know, the kind of tariffs we've had when we were a developing nation. I don't want to go off onto that, but, you know, this idea that there's a cultural problem, I do want you to address that
sure, and
systematic point.
I'm really, really glad you brought that up, because I spend a great deal of time in Betrayal of Trust talking about globalization and how our new globalized economy and our globalized perspective of international labor force that is a mobile migratory labor force now on the move all over the world, how all these things affect public health and present a whole new set of challenges. And debt forgiveness, IMF policy, World Bank policy are clearly issues on the table. And not surprisingly, Bill Clinton, as he goes into the final round of his term in office, has made debt forgiveness one of his big issues because of health. And the idea, for those who haven't followed these things, is we have imposed a certain kind of set of standards of economic development on the poorest countries in the world and on some of the countries that had once been rich and now are poor, such as Russia. And we've said to them, well, we'll give you this money. Here's some that's free money, but most of it is a loan, and you're going to have to pay off the interest over time. And here's what we want you to do with it, and here's what we're going to say you can spend it on, and here's what we're going to say you can't spend it on. For a long time, the spending tended to go towards big projects like hydroelectric dams and another international airport and so on that were thought to be boosting to the overall economy. But World Bank switched their perspective in the early 1990s as they realized the toll that HIV and other epidemics were taking and saw that health was not a sort of natural outcome of improved economics, but rather poor health impeded the improvement of economics. And so more and more, they said, money has to shift towards the health of the society, towards essential public health services, clean water, clean air, immunization programs, and so on. A rift by the late 1990s was clearly apparent between the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank over these issues, with the World Bank now the largest provider of funds for health services in the world. Nothing comes close. No government, no agency, no other UN fund comes close to spending as much on world health as does the World Bank. But the IMF was skewing everything in a totally different direction. And a lot of friction developed between the two agencies that continues today. I think that World Bank's position is that we need some serious changes in the kinds of market forces that affect public health, in particular in the pharmaceutical industry, and that we also need a great deal of debt forgiveness, particularly in the 14 nations in the world today where the HIV rate exceeds 10% of the total population. Those nations will never be able to pay off their international debts. They absolutely will never be able to do so. And to continue to demand high interest rates from them and debt interest payments when they're losing their productive labor force to this epidemic is really cruel in the extreme. And that is the World Bank position is debt forgiveness. The IMF is more reluctant.
I'm going to jump in again. I hope the caller will forgive me. We have lots of people, and the time is growing short, so I want to go on to your next caller. Is Urbana Line 2? Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple things. One is that you're really the best science writer I've ever encountered. I think they really ought to get rid of Natalie Angier and Gina Colata at the New York Times and center everything. Get you and revise their whole science page. I understand that Hyperion, your paperback has been selling more copies each year it's been out, which is, you know, amazing. I wanted to ask you about what I understand is a great instance of public health success, but I haven't had a chance to read the article. Apparently, in the Washington Post, last September, there was an article entitled Brazil Becomes Model in Fight Against AIDS, and apparently they're doing a great job with fighting AIDS. Do you know about that one?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for all your compliments. And actually, you bring up something I'd like to mention. There are some things that I researched for this book, Betrayal of Trust, but the book is big, and the publishers were worried that it was getting too big. So some of the material that I was not able to get into the book I have on a website that you might want to check out. It's www.lauriegarrett.com, and you can download freely anything. There's no copyright anything. Just take whatever you want off that website. As far as the Brazilian example goes, one of the interesting things that is now emerging to be a major confrontational issue in not just AIDS but all the public health arena concerns the pharmaceutical companies and the fact that the pharmaceutical industry is so concentrated in a handful of industrialized countries and the profit scale is so high that the cost of the drugs is prohibitive to most of the population of the world. Brazil, when that nation realized that it was being hit hard by HIV, the hardest of any Latin American nation, made a decision, and a fateful decision as it turns out. First of all, they decided that highly active antiretroviral therapy, the combination therapy approach that I was talking about earlier that's quite expensive, should be available for free, paid for by the government, to every single HIV-positive Brazilian. And in order to make that affordable to the nation, they began violating the international patents to manufacture their own copycat versions of the drugs as sold in the United States, and are able to do so at a fraction of the cost of what we pay in the U.S. for those drugs. So the first stage was they became a maverick in the international pharmaceutical market. But they didn't stop there. They also have put in a huge effort into AIDS education and in particular into dealing with HIV spread inside of their prisons and jails and in the prostitute populations and so on. And they have been able to slow the spread. They have not reversed the course of the epidemic, but they have slowed the rate at which it's growing. The country that's actually reversed, there's two countries that actually reversed the course of their epidemics, only two in the world. One is Uganda and the other is Thailand. Both of them took very different approaches since they couldn't afford to medicate their populations. Brazil, compared to Thailand, is a very rich nation. So instead of looking at this pharmaceutical model, they went for massive AIDS education efforts, just massive, and widespread access to condoms. In Uganda, they brag that nobody in Uganda, except in the most remote villages, has to go more than 5 minutes when they have the urge to find a condom. And the condoms are dirt cheap, in many cases free, and they have been able to bring their HIV infection rate down from a high of about 30% of the population to what they claim now is about 10%. I think that's a little overly optimistic, but they have brought it down. And Thailand has done the same thing. They've actually outlawed any brothel-level sexual activity without condoms. And they have done a massive education effort on teenage boys, targeting teenage boys because it had been traditional in Thailand that the first sexual activity for a teenage boy was with a prostitute. And when you had an HIV infection rate of 90% in some populations of prostitutes, That meant that boys' very first sexual encounter might be a lethal one. So they targeted at that sort of high school age group very heavily to get the boys to understand the risks they were taking. And they have had a tremendous success in Thailand.
I appreciate the caller's comment. Let's go again to next Southern Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, it's very interesting, and I bless you for doing all this hard work, and you're very, it's just so important. I'm very frustrated living in a rural area for the past 20 years and watching the local farmers spread poisons, atrazine, pesticides, herbicides on the land, and I've seen it drift into gardens, and into my house, into the aquifers. And I'm wondering if you have any chapters in your book, or can you tell me where I can go to help fight this no-till application? They're just pouring the chemicals on, and I'm just frustrated. I've watched my neighbor's garden just be ruined. I've watched the Tri-County Electric Company here take down hedgerow after hedgerow of dicamba 2,4-D. And I understand all these chemicals that they're banning here, farming chemicals. They send over to third world countries and ship the food back. And do you address any of that in your book or your study?
Yes. I think the interesting thing is that the oldest conflict in public health, a sort of theme that has run through from the very beginnings of public health in the 1880s, 1890s, has been between what's in the interest of economic development versus what's in the interest of community health. And if you look at old New York City, for example, you can see that when Tammany Hall, the very corrupt party machine, was in power, they basically would gut public health and appoint all their little corrupt cronies into the offices, and they would forbid public health intervention into any businesses so that people couldn't, you know, go into the shirtwaist factories and say, you can't have 12-year-old children working here in the dark, in these unsafe conditions. This is poor public health, poor community health, things of that nature. What we've seen as we've gotten into the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st is that we have several key arenas of conflict between sort of economic prosperity and community health prosperity. And one of them clearly has to do with agricultural practices. The United States is the major agricultural producer of the world, and it's something that we should be very proud of. And I've spent enough time, I grew up on a ranch as a kid, and I know a lot about farming, and it's darned hard work. And, you know, I'm all for the family farmer in America. But one of the problems that we've consistently faced is USDA policy and state agricultural policy versus public health policy, and the inability of public health to be seen as an equal partner in assessing the impacts of the chemicals we use. And I think even more concern for me is the agricultural use of antibiotics, which I think we can now very definitely show is associated with increased health risk to human beings, because of the breeding of drug-resistant forms of bacteria that then cause far more dangerous disease in human beings. And we now have documented case after documented case after documented case of the emergence of drug-resistant strains of bacteria that originated in livestock that were, or poultry or aquaculture, where there was heavy treatment of the animals with antibiotics. And most people don't realize that antibiotic use is not for veterinary purposes. It's not curative for the animal. It's as a growth promoter. So they're giving it in their feed on a regular basis.
There's large poultry farms and hog farms in these counties, and I know they're using heavy applications of that, and that's also going in the aquifers. Is there no one paying attention to any of this?
Well, you know, here's what I say to people when again, it's a trust, okay? Public health is a trust. And so what I say in Betrayal of Trust is that you have to be a citizen. You have to be an engaged citizen. And if your question is our aquifer safe, then what you have to first ask at the state level and at your county level is, how many people have we got on the payroll who actually do testing of the aquifers? Do we actually know the answer? How regularly are they going in there and doing tests? And what do they test for?
So I would go to my public health department and ask them,
yes,
and start there?
And if they don't have the answers, then there's an accountability issue there. You know, these people work for you. You pay them taxes. So they have to answer your questions. I briefly worked for the California Department of Food and Agriculture and was in charge of assessing the human health impacts of pesticides quite a number of years ago. And one of the things I found that was really startling was that at that time, we only actually had the technological capacity to test water for about a couple of dozen chemicals. We had 33,000 pesticide formulations in use in the state of California, and we could actually only test for the presence of a couple of dozen of them in drinking water. And we could only test for the presence of a handful of them in the air. Testing has become a little better now. There have been some improvements. But, you know, if you're worried about it, you have to be a citizen and get engaged and ask your public health authorities, what do you test for? What if you had a bigger budget, you know, what more could you do? Do I want to agitate for, in a supportive way of public health, to get a bigger budget, get more people on board, take this more seriously, or do I think these guys are sloughing off on the job and I want to agitate against them and say, you know, you're not doing the job you're supposed to do? I mean, I think it requires you take a role as a citizen, which involves a little bit of work on your part.
I agree with you. And does your book, Betrayal of Trust, deal with any of that?
Yeah. I don't spend a lot of time on chemical pollution, but you'll find the references and the tools you need to get you started.
Thank you very much.
Right, thanks for the call. We're almost out of time here. I do want to mention, by the way, that at the end of the program here, a minute or two, we have an extra copy of the book, Betrayal of Trust, and we're going to give it away. And I'll give you a number to call. And the first person in, I'm sorry, we just have the one copy, but we'd like to find a home for it. So we're going to do that. So stay with us here for another minute or two. I want to try to get at least one more caller in here. We'll have to be quick. Belgium, line 3.
Yes, sir, and I will be quick. The whole premise that you're dealing with, ma'am, which is a good premise, does deal with the concept that we think we are the premier species on the earth. Sometimes we do need predators for ourselves. Maybe AIDS is that one. Thank you very much.
Ooh. Well, that's a pretty grim view. You know, that's sort of like saying that thermonuclear war is inevitable or disaster is inevitable. You'll have to forgive me, but I choose to be an optimist. I'm not able to accept such a cynical view.
Well, unfortunately, that's the note we'll have to end on, but I want to make sure that I mention again to folks that there is much more on this subject you might look at, and you will find it in the book that we mentioned. It's titled Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. Hyperion is the publisher. Also, you might want to look at Lori Garrett's previous book, The Coming Plague, which is about the reemergence of infectious disease around the world. Lori Garrett is a reporter for Newsday. She's been there since 1988, and you may remember the days when she worked for National Public Radio as a science correspondent. Ms. Garrett, we want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, and I hope all your listeners will be healthy and be well.